This is an AMI podcast.
Are you ready?
Let's go.
From AMI Central.
Now circling in the neutral zone.
Here's the pitch on the way. 36 yards for the win.
This.
Here comes a big chance. The shot.
Is this the dagger?
The neutral zone.
Oh, home run. Good.
This is as good as it gets.
Now, here's your host, two-time Paralympian, Brock Richardson.
What's going on? It's time for another edition of the Neutral Zone. And guess what? I am indeed your host, Brock Richardson. I've been away for the last little while. Came back, excited to give you another wonderful program. Let me tell you a little bit about what's coming up on said program. We release another interview from the Canadian Paralympic Committee Summit. Today we speak with long jump athlete Jesse Zazu, from Toronto, Ontario. Plus, we're going to talk a little bit about Major League Baseball as we head into the last leg of the season, and the trade deadline is almost upon us as we record this episode. I'm joined by Josh Watson and Cam Jenkins. Let's get into our headlines for this week.
Neutral Zone Headlines.
Well, speaking of Jesse Zazu, the National Championships for Para-Athletics took place in BC. Here are a couple of the highlights. Jesse Zazu won the para-ambulatory discus throw for men with a throw of 50.47 meters. I'm a discus thrower myself. I don't know how you throw something that far, but congratulations, Jesse. Also, Renee Fossel wins the F-38 ambulatory discus with a throw of 34.64 meters. She's just coming off of a competition at the World Championships in Paris, and that is a very, very good throw for her. And just for a little flavor, let's add in a couple of the able-bodied events. Aaron Brown won the men's senior 100-meter race in a time of 10.08 seconds. And Andre DeGrasse won the men's senior 200-meter race in a time... No, I don't have the time, but he won. So that's good enough.
After 1,294 games and one Stanley Cup in the NHL, Canadian Patrice Bergeron has decided to call it a career. He also had a decorated international career, winning 5 gold medals for Canada at various international events. Congratulations on a wonderful career. Best of luck in your future retirement. And I have to honestly say that when names like Patrice Bergeron start retiring, that means that I'm climbing up in age, because I grew up watching Patrice Bergeron and now he's retiring. Not sure what that says about me, but congratulations, Patrice, on a wonderful career.
I think it means that both Brock and I are both old. The Women's World Cup of Soccer is rolling on. Canada played Australia in their most recent game. The final score was 4-0, which makes their record 1 win, 1 draw, and 1 loss. Australia putting this all together, this means Canada is eliminated after the group stage in the 2023 Women's World Cup, which we'll be talking a little bit later in the show.
Those are your headlines for this week. And just on a general sense, I want to sort of talk about two different chat topics today. I want you, both of your general thoughts on the World Cup. Canada, as Cameron so eloquently just told us, did not make it past the group stage. Would you say this was a success, failure, somewhere in between? Start with you, Josh, since it was not your headline.
Honestly, I am very disappointed in the way this particular World Cup has shaken out for Canada. I don't know if it's the change at head coach or just the players being a little bit older, but in my opinion, this was not the team we saw at the Olympics that won a gold medal. I watched the first game against Nigeria, or at least most of it, and I don't think I've ever seen Christine Sinclair miss a penalty kick like she did in that game. It was completely obvious where she was going with the ball, and I don't think the Nigerian keeper had that difficult a save to make on the play, and that could have given them a win in that game instead of a draw. So I see after today's game against Australia that Christine Sinclair did retire. I feel bad that that's the way she has to go out, but this was not, in my opinion, a good showing for Canada at all.
Yeah, it wasn't a good showing, especially after winning gold at the Olympics. I think it was a huge letdown. I watched the game today, and, you know, they were down 2-0, and it could have very well been 3-0 at the half. And they just seemed discombobulated. The pressure that Australia put on the Canadians was unbelievable. And Christine Sinclair, as I understand, she doesn't see herself playing in another World Cup, I believe is what she said. So if that was her last game in for Canada, thank you, Christine Sinclair, for representing your country so well over the years. And I believe, if not in all of women's soccer, certainly in Canada, she has certainly scored the most points and goals for Canada. So it's just so unfortunate that it had to go down like this, because they did not play well today.
It's almost like today, Christine sort of wanted to sort of put like a bit of a shining light on something that wasn't very good. And what I mean by shining light is the fact that if she in fact does not play another game, and, you know, it would seem that way, I think, you know, we can all in Canada say, well, she did wonderful things. And let's not also forget the fact that she's 40 years old. I don't know many 40-year-old individuals in my world who can compete at a high level like that and be running for, you know, the better part of 90 minutes in a soccer game. You know, to have that level of athleticism at that age is something that's pretty incredible. And so on a sort of a bitter pill to swallow, as I try to speak English today, this is kind of a shining light, because Christine Sinclair needs to, you know, have all the flowers. She's had a great career, and I agree with both of you. It's just sort of a disappointing way for her and the team to go out. I did, on a conversation I had this morning, it was brought up, well, you know, maybe it's all the stuff that's going on in Soccer Canada. And my answer to that this morning was, yes, that is part of it. But I also think the other portion of this is, as professional athletes, you need to put that on the back burner, and you need to go out onto the pitch in this case and put everything aside and play your game to the best of your ability. And I don't think I saw that today, or at all throughout this tournament.
And it was ridiculous that they wouldn't see the media before this game either. Like, you're trying to grow the game of women's soccer and women Canadian soccer, and you don't even do any media availabilities because you're trying to psych yourself up for this game. I just don't think that was very good on Team Canada's part to make that decision. I just think it's pretty despicable.
Yeah, I think you need to make yourself available to media when media presents itself, because there are some sports out there that don't get the same recognition and that would starve for media attention. So when it's given, I think you need to at least accommodate it in some level. I'm not suggesting that every athlete should be available to every media member, but, you know, dedicate somebody to go to the media, because 100%. You deserve that, and so does the media and the country of Canada and whatever the case may be. So I agree with you, Cameron. I don't like that either. Something that I want to get your quick thoughts on, both of you, starting with Cameron. The MLB trade deadline is August 1st. In light of this, I thought I would ask you both, what is your favorite trade deadline day and why, Cameron?
Well, my favorite trade deadline, which might be also yours as well, it's from a Blue Jays perspective, and it's when Alex Anthopoulos was here, and he sold the farm and got people like David Price and Troy Tulowitzki, I believe, was in that trade deadline, and there was other ones too, where he just went for it, and it didn't matter if it was a rental or if it was a person that had a lot of years still on their contract left. Like, he just went for it, and that was fun because they also made the playoffs that year. So the only other trade deadline I can think of And you know what? I don't want to even say that one because I don't even think it was a trade deadline. I think this one probably happened at the winter meetings when Fred McGriff was traded, and I believe it was for Robbie Alomar. And I believe Joe Carter was in there too, or something along those lines. But like I said, I think that was at the winter meetings. But that's another big trade that happened that sticks out in my head.
Also, Alex Anthopoulos didn't really care. He was emptying out the cupboards because he knew that he probably wasn't coming back with Paul Beeston and company. Josh, do you have a favorite deadline, whether it's, you know, within Major League Baseball or just major sports in general?
Not one that really stands out. Unfortunately, my memory is just not strong enough, to be honest, to go back a long ways. I mean, I do remember 1992 and 93, and I'm sure there were deadline deals there that were enough to put us over the top because we did win those two World Series. It seems to me, was it? I think David Cohn came in on a deadline deal that one of those years.
Yep, and he did.
A couple of others. But I do agree with Cameron that that deadline where Tulowitzki and David Price, those deals, those were certainly exciting. Anytime my team, the Blue Jays, ends up deciding to do anything more than a minor move, I get excited. But overall, I look at it, were there a lot of deals? If there's a lot of deals flying around, then that's exciting to me. It doesn't necessarily have to be my own team, but there's been a few this year so far, and it'll be interesting to see if the Jays pull off anything else. They've apparently acquired Jordan Hicks from the Cardinals, one of the best closers or at least relief pitchers in the game right now, so that'll be exciting. But to pick a particular deadline that really stood out, unfortunately, they all kind of go together for me.
Yeah, those 92 and 93 deadlines, as you alluded to, Josh, they were good too, because I think, and I'm usually not good at remembering these things, but I believe Mookie Wilson was around the trade deadline that we got him, and I think even Candy Maldonado. There's a name for you. That's a way back playback.
Yeah, trade deadline days are definitely fun in whatever way that you consume them. And, you know, from a consumer perspective, I love the way that, you know, the NHL does their TV, and, you know, you get like 15 hours of coverage. I think the MLB is one of those ones that, you know, trades can kind of slip away from you because you don't, unless you're on Twitter/X, whatever the heck we're calling this now, it can kind of slip away from you in that regard. And so for me, I love MLB. I think you see a lot of trades happen, but from a consumer perspective and television product, I love the NHL. I think they do a really good job in Canada of allocating time and effort. Sometimes it's ridiculousness that you see, and you know, on the three-letter TSN, but it's always fun. I hope that we see more acquisitions from the Blue Jays, and we'll see how things go. Go ahead, Cameron.
Yeah, I was just going to say that with the NHL, I think they've set it up in such a way that it's great to have that one day. And you know, I used to have a TV set up, my computer, and I was going back and forth and figuring out all the trades. But I think the salary cap has wrecked it. Because now it just seems to be an older player that used to be good for a draft pick day. And that's because of the salary cap. Whereas in baseball, and yes, the NBA has a salary cap, but it's not a hard one like the NHL. So I think those two leagues, especially the NBA, man, those deadline deals, those are exciting these days. So I would have said originally the NHL before the salary cap, but I would probably go as far as trade deadlines go, NBA, Major League Baseball, and then hockey.
Awesome. Giving us a top three there. If you like what you heard and you want to get a hold of us on social media, here's how you can do that.
And welcome back to the Neutral Zone AMI broadcast booth.
Play ball.
And we are set to get this ball game underway. The first pitch brought to you by Brock Richardson's Twitter account at Neutral Zone BR.
Steve.
First pitch, strike. And hey, gang, why not strike up a Twitter chat with Claire Buchanan from the Neutral Zone? Find her at Neutral Zone CB. And there's a swing and a chopper out to second base right at Claire. She picks up the ball, throws it over to first base for a routine out. And fans, there is nothing routine about connecting with Cam and Josh from the Neutral Zone. At Neutral Zone, Cam J and at JWatson200. Now that's a winning combination. And this Oregon interlude is brought to you by AMI Audio on Twitter. Get in touch with the Neutral Zone. Type in at AMI Audio.
We released another Canadian Paralympic Committee Summit interview that I did back in March. Today we speak with Jesse Zazu from Toronto, Ontario. He is a long jump athlete, and please enjoy the interview.
Okay, so I understand you were not born in Canada. What has Canada done for you in the world of parasport?
It's given me the opportunity to compete at a high level and have the resources to compete at that high level. I think that if in Cameroon, it's a little less developed, so especially sport in Cameroon, let alone parasport. So I think Canada afforded me that ability to further achieve my goals athletically.
Now, you compete in long jump, and I have had visions all day of how does one learn that they're good at long jump or like long jump. Does this mean that you're jumping from the kitchen to the dining room and going, "Mom, look how far I jumped"? Like, how does one figure this out?
So in elementary school, I was always into either basketball or just running in general. But then in grade six, I remember that I came second in the city Toronto City Championships for standing long jump in the able body category. So I guess that's how I figured out I was pretty good at long jump. Yeah, I always just could jump far horizontally and vertically. Yeah,
and is that something you can, it's something you can practice basically anywhere to a point. You can literally just jump on your lawn, and is that how you learn and grew in the early stages of this? Is just doing it on your own time before you competed at a high level?
I think just different sports that involved a lot of jumping helped a lot. I was always a pretty active kid. I'd go out in the backyard and just do a bunch of random stuff, do a bunch of flips and tricks and whatever in the backyard. So it was just, I think that inadvertently helped me pseudo-train for long jump, yeah.
You have set Canadian records. How hard is that to do, to set a record?
I mean, it's all relative, I think. Could be difficult for someone, could be easy for some other people. I mean, I think the years of working out and improving my explosiveness, improving my abilities, getting stronger helped out a lot, and made it easier in the moment than it would have been otherwise.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the just training regimen that goes into competing at a high level?
Especially for my events, all of my events that I do are pretty based on power, speed, and just strength. So I essentially, in the weight room, for example, we just do a lot of lifting heavy or lifting heavy things really fast, whether that be mostly leg stuff, and also outdoors, just having good quality, less about quantity than more about quality. Because all my events are pretty technical. Long jump is actually a pretty technical event. It doesn't sound like it, but it actually is, and so is discus. So just honing in on your technique on the field, and then getting stronger, getting more explosive.
Do you have a favorite event that you do? And on the contrary, is there one that you're just like, "Oh, I don't like this"?
In terms of favorite event, I like discus and long jump pretty equally. I think it's also because those are my best ones. In terms of unfavorable events, right now that probably would be shot put, because I know one of the national team coaches wants me to do shot put, and I don't know. It's I'm already 80 pounds lighter than all the discus throwers in my category in the world, and I can, so I can just use my speed and technique. But shot put is much more about brute like force and just mass, and it's a little harder for me than some of those guys. So that's probably shot put. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. I understand. For you, when you look at the Paralympics, obviously that's the goal, to continue to progress and do that. For you, what's the long-term goal in parasports?
The long-term goal is to be the best multi-event athlete I can possibly be, and hopefully be the best multi-event athlete in my category or in parasport in general. Especially because there's a lot of athletes that have won many medals in just running or in just throwing or in just jumping, but I want a medal in all three at some point in my life. So that'd be the overall goal. And that's what I'm hoping we can do all the way, especially in LA 2028, when I'll be further along in my career.
There's always something amusing that takes place in someone's career that, you know, you can think back to and say, yeah, when this happened, this was funny and I enjoyed it. For you, what would you say the sort of the funny side of your career has been?
In terms of the funny side, I mean, it's not funny, but I take it as funny because I don't know, I just kind of laughed when it happened. So it was, so the day before I went on the plane to go get classified in Arizona for the first ever competition as a paired athlete, I hyperextended my knee and so I couldn't run, walk properly for like 3 months afterwards. So that was the day before I got on the plane. And so that was just like, come on, are you serious right now? So it was more so just like I had to laugh it off because I couldn't get too angry at myself. And luckily that helped me like focus in on discus, and that's where I got the marks to get on the national team.
Training and competing is not always easy. What's the most challenging thing for you, training and competing in your career?
It's definitely the bad days where it feels as though you just forgot how to do the event, you have a technical day where you're just trying to focus on one thing, you just cannot do it. You spend an hour and a half, 2 hours trying to do this one thing in your technique and you can't do it. It's really very, very, very frustrating. But it's just learning how to just not get too high on emotions and stay even keel. So the next day, you can go at it again with a very short-term memory and just go at it with a fresh slate.
What does the Canadian Paralympic Committee and the Paralympic movement mean to you as a whole?
It means a lot. It's given me the opportunity to travel the world, visit other countries that I've never been able to do before. Give me the opportunity to compete at a high level and compete safely at a high level, and also just supported me all the way through it. So, yeah, it's been really, really special.
And obviously there's always room for growth. Where do you see the Canadian Paralympic Committee needing to grow themselves and the movement?
I think it's just more advocacy and more awareness for the Paralympic movement. The fact that I was 21 years old when I found out I would be eligible for the Paralympics, I think that should have happened sooner, and it can happen sooner. There's probably a bunch of other people out there that are eligible and probably will be very competitive within parasport that just don't know that it's possible.
It's so hard to balance your personal life and your career because funding doesn't always come in the ways that we hope it does. How do you find it successful to balance your personal life and your career?
Mm-hmm. In terms of personal life and funding and stuff, it is hard, especially I just finished being a student, so it is hard that way. But on the flip side of being a student, I live pretty cheaply. I live in a student house at that point, so it's a little cheaper rent and everything. In terms of personal life, it's just a little less social time, but like I have no FOMO or fear of missing out. I know what my goals are, and I still have time for my friends and my family, but I also know what the objective is and what I'm doing. So,
can you tell us more a little bit about your studies?
Mm-hmm. Oh, so I took political science and marketing at University of Guelph.
And what's the hope there.
So I have a job lined up for next year, hopefully to an advertising agency, and work in digital marketing as an account executive there. So especially with that, it would be part-time and remote. So that works perfectly with my schedule as an athlete, where I'm not even in Canada for 3-4 months out of the year.
When we pack, we obviously pack the things we need. But there's always that thing that's the comfort thing, the thing that makes us feel grounded. For you, what's the thing that you say, I must have this in my bag in order for me to feel a piece of home or just a level of comfort?
I don't really have any, like, souvenirs. It's more, like, practical stuff, I would say. Like I can't travel without, if I forget my headphones, like, I don't know what I'm going to do at that point. Because, I absolutely need my headphones either on the plane or if I'm sharing a room with someone in the dorm that I'm in. I think it's more so that. I don't have really any, like, souvenirs or anything that I travel with or anything.
Athletes are creatures of habit. Do you believe that's important as an athlete? And if so, why?
Yes, I believe I'd characterize it as just repetition. The point of most of any sport, it's about repetition. Training is boring sometimes and is hard. And it's just about repetition until you get it right. So forming those good habits, not only on the field of play and also on when you're practicing, but also it delves into nutrition as well too. Like just being consistent, finding what you like in terms of food that fuels you. For example, I've eaten the same version of a breakfast every day when I'm at home for the last 6-7 years of my life. Just being really consistent with that and it's just a combination of oatmeal, fruit, and protein powder in any form. I either make waffles, a smoothie, or yeah.
Wow. There's going to be people that are listening to this that aren't involved in parasports or haven't begun their journey of being involved in parasport. Why should somebody take that first proverbial step and get involved?
Because there's no use in just putting it off. If you know that you can, if you know that you're eligible, you know that you have a chance to compete, just do it. There's what's the fear and stop? There's no need to put it off because it's not always going to be there. Your opportunity and your body while you're young or while you're old, I don't know, if you want to compete as an older person, isn't always going to be there. So just take it.
Thank you so much for doing this interview. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was long jump athlete Jesse Zazu, who is from Toronto, Ontario. And again, I spoke with him in March at the Canadian Paralympic Committee Summit. If you like what you heard in the interview, please give us a call at our voicemail, which can be found right here.
If you want to leave a message for the Neutral Zone, call now, 1-866-509-4545. And don't forget to give us permission to use your message on the air. Let's get ready to leave a voicemail!
Sometimes I feel that I'm a glutton for punishment, and I'll tell you why. Because I put on the remaining of the docket, Major League Baseball, which is because the trade deadline is approaching, as we mentioned off the top of the show. But I know that this opens up one of my co-hosts to talk about Yusei Kikuchi during our conversation. And there's 26 minutes left in the show. So I'm sure that at some point in the next 25 and a half minutes, I guess if I keep talking, then I can just kill more and more time that we don't have to talk about it.
But edgewise somewhere.
I just know that we're going to be talking about it somewhere down the line. And you know what, Cameron, I'll say this for you, deservedly so, maybe we do need to talk about Yusei Kikuchi, as you tend to throw stats at me in Twitter and X or whatever. Maybe you could throw them out on the program that you've done the last little while. So I leave this to you as we delve through this next 26 minutes or so. But let's start here before we start talking about the trade deadline specifically and the Blue Jays. Over the last 50 games, they have had
the best record in the American League, and something like having 30 wins when I looked at this stat and 20 losses. They have had one of the best records all told in every other division when they played each division, except for the American League East, where they've only won something like 8 games all together. So before we delve into the trade deadline itself, what would you say about the Toronto Blue Jays and where they are right now as we head into the last leg of the season? Cameron, start with you.
Oh, where to start? I know that the Jays, they have been good over the past while, and one of the best records in baseball since, I forget, you know, what the date is, but it doesn't feel like it. With that bullpen, it really needs to shore up. You know, I think Schneider has been using the bullpen way too much, and he needs to be able to trust his starters a bit more. And yeah, I'm going to bring up Kikuchi because he always seems to get Kikuchi out of the game.
Darn, I didn't kill enough time.
But seriously, like Kikuchi, he always pulls them by the fourth or fifth inning, and Kikuchi is doing well during those innings. And I don't know, especially the, I think it was the last outing Kikuchi had, I don't understand why Schneider would pull him out. And obviously it has to do with analytics and what Kikuchi usually does after 4 or 5 innings, or probably after 2 or 3 times through the lineup. But if he's pitching that well, give him a bit of leeway, because you know you have to rest some of your bullpen. They've been overused way too much, and you know, thank God that we ended up getting the relief pitcher from St. Louis. But I think that was more so because Jordan Romano is out with, I think it was lower back problems or stiffness. So, you know, when's Romano going to be coming back? And is this St. Louis pitcher going to end up being the closer, you know, from now to the end of the season? I really hope that it doesn't affect Romano too much. But yeah, like I think Kikuchi, he has pitched really well. You got the other pitchers besides Manoah, but you have him back up. His first start was really good. Next start didn't go so well, and I don't know what he did in his third start, or if he's had a third start.
It was
Yeah. So, like, are you going to end up putting Manoah in the bullpen? Like, it seems like Manoah's getting more innings than Kikuchi is. Like, when he's not doing as well, like, I just don't get it.
I can understand your point about that, and there are times where I agree with you that the rope needs to be extended, the leash needs to be longer. But I think what it comes down to with Kikuchi is that once he gets into that third or fourth time through that lineup, things just go south, and they go south in a hurry with him, unfortunately. I do agree with you. He's been 100% better than he was last year. But I still have my doubts. Unfortunately, I have fewer doubts with him than I do with Alek Manoah. I don't think they should have brought him back up as soon as they did. I think they should have brought Hyunjin Ryu up before Manoah, quite frankly. Because you send him down, he gets shelled in the Florida Complex League. He comes up, he makes a start at AA and does okay. And you magically decide, okay, he's fixed.
It's magic, Josh.
No, that's not how that works. I need a track record. I need a track record of consistent application of what he's been shown in the minor leagues before I give him the cookie of you're now a major league starter again. As far as I'm concerned, if you get demoted, you have to earn your way back. I'm not convinced he did. Having said that, it was pretty obvious to me that the likes of Bassett and Berríos and Gausman obviously went to management and said, do something, we're not staying on a 4-man rotation here. So I guess they didn't have a choice. They apparently don't have anyone at AAA that they feel comfortable bringing up. They apparently don't have anyone at AA that they feel comfortable bringing up. So that's the part that scares me the most. Is that bullpen and that starting rotation. Because if 3 of 4 of them hit the skids at the same time, we're in trouble. But having said that, we do have Ryu coming up. He's going to make a start, I believe it's tomorrow against Baltimore. So that will be interesting. He's pitched very well in the minor leagues, so I have no problem with him coming and joining the rotation. I don't even mind if you skip Manoa once or twice until he shows you that he can be solid, because that second start after he came back was scary. And that's against a very good team. If you can't pitch against the very good teams, you don't belong
and
there. Personally, I don't think we're going to see any... Sorry, Cameron, I know you want to get in here. I don't see us making any huge moves at the deadline other than Jordan Hicks, because I think Chad Green will be our pickup, assuming that he's well enough to step in and be a leverage reliever. And I think that's where your rest for your bullpen is going to come.
Yeah, I think that they definitely need that bullpen pitcher that they got. They're looking for a right-handed bat as well. I think they're going to do something by tomorrow, you know, in regards to that. You know, like it's
1 year.
I guess it's just very frustrating that the pitching is where it is. You know, and they're certainly not babying Ryu when he comes back, because they're putting him right into the fire to pitch against Baltimore, was the point I was going to make. So it's going to be really interesting to see what Ryu is like, and after coming back from Tommy John surgery and throwing him right into the fire. I'm really interested to see how he's going to pitch and how he's going to pitch the rest of the way, because, you know, I'm pretty confident in saying that the Jays are going to make the playoffs. So it's going to be interesting to see how they put all the pitchers together and who they're going to have as their starters and who they're going to throw in the bullpen. Because especially if it's a wild card, I think that's the best of three. Depending on which game, if it's just a one-game playoff, it could be just one game.
It's best of three.
Best of three. Okay. So you know, like a lot of the pitchers, I think are going to be thrown in the bullpen anyway as long relievers. Because who are you going to have your three? Gausman. Who are the other two in your opinions that would end up starting a series besides Gausman?
For me, it's easy. It's Gausman, it's Barrios, and it's Bassett.
Bassett,
those are my guys. Those have been the three guys that have carried this team the whole way. Now, if any one of those three gets hurt, then you've got an issue. Do you put in Manoa, do you put in Kikuchi, or do you put in Ryu, who has only had a few starts?
Right now, I'd put Kikuchi.
And you better put...
I'd put Kikuchi in, obviously.
I was going to say that. You better put in Kikuchi, and I can't believe that's coming out of my mouth right now, but... You better put in Kikuchi, because that individual has earned the right to be that fourth guy in that need, if there's a need for it. The biggest mistake, I don't know if I've said this publicly, I haven't been here in a long time, so I don't remember what I said on the air, but the biggest mistake that I believe that the Toronto Blue Jays made was giving Alek Manoah the opening day start. Why they gave it to him, I will forever not understand. And I know it's only one game, I understand that. But I've been an athlete in many different levels, and those kinds of pressure moments really play on your psyche. And it's a real problem. And he ran into a situation where he hit somebody in the face in one of the games against LA. That's going to play against your psyche, because I'm sorry, if you're human, you're going to feel that. The sound, I will never forget that sound that I heard. It was like, ow, that's not good. And the individual for the LA Angels is not going to be coming back this season, obviously. But it's just, there's been so many things stacked up against Alek Manoah this year that it's pretty unbelievable when you think about it. And for me... the first thing I looked at and I said, was the action of bringing him down to the minors, was it just the action versus what he actually accomplished down in the minors? Because to me, you brought him up way, way, way too quickly in this situation. And he hasn't proven to me, other than the first start, which I want to remind the viewers out there, the first start that he played was against the Detroit Tigers. Between myself, Cameron and Josh, I'm pretty sure we could have done okay against the Detroit Tigers this year. And, you know, we're not major league players. But, and I don't mean to disrespect Alek here either, but It's just the reality of the situation. You have to look against his opponent, and yes, you can only play who you're in front of. That's all well and good. That's fine. I'm okay with that. For me, guys, the thing that I want to bring up in all this, and I was at the game Sunday afternoon, and I watched George Springer come up four times, and he flew out four times. And yeah, we moved him from the, you know, top of the lineup to the fifth hole, and we put Whit Merrifield at the top. Great, been a real good difference. But at some point, we need to have the conversation of, what are we doing with George Springer? Yes, he was on the paternal leave list, and since he's been back, he's been god-awful, and then whatever. But everyone looks at George Springer and says, oh, you paid him so much money. He's your guy. You know, we got to keep running him out there. No, you don't. Because if you sent Alek Manoah down for the same reasons of what I believe are mental struggles, then you want to do that with George Springer. Not send him down necessarily, but put him on the IL. Make up some injury, and I know I shouldn't be saying this. Make up some injury that says he's going to be on the injured list for 15 days because he's not productive. I mean, I was sitting in the audience, and the person I went with was literally genuinely like, we need a pinch hitter. I'd rather him in the 10th inning, you know, strike out rather than hitting into a double play, which he ended up striking out in this instance, because he's too much of a liability in the sense of in the end of a game, you don't know whether he's going to hit into a double play, strikeout. He's just not there. And so for me, do something more with George Springer, not versus Alek Manoah. You did it to Alek Manoah, so do it to George Springer. Your thoughts on this, both of you? Josh, start with you.
I was just about to say, I think they read your mind, Brock, because I read something about 45 minutes ago, just before we came on air, where he is actually being sat tonight. Springer will not be in the lineup.
Good.
So yeah. I think you can't necessarily send him down or I'm sure there are Major League Baseball rules against falsifying injuries, but I agree with you that you do need to sit him down and say, we've got Dalton Varsho, we've got Kevin Kiermaier, we've got
Kevin Biggio.
Kevin Biggio. We've got enough outfielders that you can take a couple days off, go down in the cage, figure out your swing, and then come back. But for now, until you earn your place, that's what's going to happen to you. There needs to be more of a meritocracy on this team. You need to earn your spot in that lineup. Whit Merrifield, he's earned his spot in the lineup. Whether he's in the outfield, whether he's at second base, wherever he is, he deserves to be there. He is proving that he was a good pickup. Even a Dalton Varsho, he brings things to the game that you need. So he's earned his spot. Kevin Kiermaier does things, whether it's in the field or at bat, that earn him a place. Some of these other guys, especially some of the bigger name guys, I question that sometimes. And I think we've seen it in the past where guys will get a day off here and there because they're just not pulling their weight. And I really think that needs to happen more.
As far as you know, this discussion goes, if anyone's going to get sent down before anybody, it should be Varsho, because he's not hitting well at all either. And yes, he has defensive capabilities, which, you know, is helping to save some runs. But, you know, when you think of the other player, he also is in right field, not in center field anymore. And he's doing really good defensively as well. So there's a heck of a lot of other players I would send down if you're going to send down somebody rather than that individual that we're speaking of, George Springer. And they were commenting on the game that yesterday that he was hitting the ball well, that it just wasn't falling, but he was getting good contact on it and hitting the ball well, but it just wasn't dropping. So I think that's, you know, everybody goes through slumps through the entire year. I believe with not Biggio, but the Chapman, I think they were complaining about him for a while. They were complaining about Vladdy Jr. He's not hitting a lot of home runs.
Still are complaining about Vladdy Jr.
they were complaining about him because he wasn't getting any hits. I think he went through 13 games of not getting a hit or something like that. I forget the actual stats, but he's just going through a bad time. He started to hit the ball well. And if they do pull him for non-injury related reasons, especially when he hit the ball well, he just didn't get any hits, I think it's the wrong thing to do personally.
Well, I this is where I disagree with you. Moving George Springer from the first position to the fifth position does nothing for me, scratches no itch, does nothing. Because you know what? He leads off a game once a game. Then the lineup just becomes the lineup. Moving him from first to fifth does nothing. Maybe there's some analytics of like, well, if you, you know, hit first, you hit more times than everybody else. Well, that's a no-brainer. But I just, yesterday watching the game, I look at George Springer and I say, buddy, you look lost. You, like, even balls and strikes.
But he was hitting the ball hard
it
yesterday.
It doesn't matter. Did it fall? No, it didn't fall. So
no, but there's a huge difference between pop-ups or strikeouts compared to balls being hit hard and just not dropping or getting hit right at, you know, the outfielder or whatever the case is, compared to pop-outs or strikeouts or like that is lost. But hitting the ball hard, but it just happens to go right to the outfielder, that's not lost.
You know what I remember out of yesterday's game? I remember the fact that he went 0-for-4. I don't sit here and think, well, yeah, he flew out to each of the left fielder, center fielder, right fielder. I mean, I remember that because my the person I went with joked about that he's you know, hit to every fielder, one he hit to twice in the outfield. But I don't remember that. What I remember is you didn't get on base. What I remember is in the 10th inning, people were literally like, we'd rather just make the out versus let him hit because he's a liability in making a double play. Now, am I suggesting that we trade him? Absolutely not.
No.
I'm not suggesting that at all. I just think he needs to take a seat, and it needs to be for more than one game, in my opinion. He needs to take a seat, and he needs to sit there and work on his swing mentally, you know, sitting on the bench.
Brock, you're not going to remember Brock when he hits a home run to win a wild card series. You're not going to remember this conversation of him getting out four times in a row and hitting the ball hard. You're going to be like, oh yeah, George Springer's the best. He hit a home run and it was game winning. And you're not going to remember
this. Trust me, I'll remember it because I have a coworker like you that doesn't let me forget anything at all
it's
what I
YouTube.
Said. So you
Fair
will
enough.
Pull it up and you will tell Mark or whoever is our technical producer on that given day, we need to run this because I will. And so, yeah, you will not let me forget this one iota that this happened. But no, I just think that's the way it is. He needs to sit for a while, Josh.
It goes back to a bigger problem I think I see with the Blue Jays hitters. And we see it go against us time and time again. It's not easy to do. I'm not going to claim that. But situational hitting. Okay, they're shading you to, say, right field. Everybody's swung over to the right because they think you're going to pull the baseball. Have some awareness and dump a single into left field. Like, there are ways that you can hit the ball, timing-wise and other things, that allow you to play based on what the defense is giving you. I'm going to age myself here, but Tony Gwynn and Ozzie Smith were wizards at doing that. They would look at what the defense was giving them and go, oh, there's a hole over there. I'm going to hit it there. And they would. That art of the game is lost. And I don't know why. It's like all we can do now is hit the ball hard and, oh, well, it went to all three outfielders. Well, big deal. No, it is a big deal because it's keeping you from winning games. And I have watched players for other teams come into Rogers Center or play against the Blue Jays at their home park, and they do it. So why can't we? What is going on?
And you know, one of the real reasons, in my opinion, and this is across Major League Baseball, this isn't just Toronto Blue Jays. One of the real reasons they got rid of the shift was because somebody would play somebody extremely to the right towards first base. And mm-hmm. you would see time and time
Ridiculous.
Again, that person just hit it right into the shift, and the commentator, whoever it would be, would say the words, hit it right into the shift, hit it right into the shift. And for me, and this is a little bit facetious, welcome back, I'm being totally facetious this week on the program, but like, it's, I would always say, bunt and run a mile. Like, bunt through that open side and run for days. Because there's nobody on the left side of the infield when everyone's shaded up towards first base, because they all think you're gonna hit there. So bunt and run for days, because that's going to change the shift. Now Major League Baseball came in and said, no, we're gonna change the shift, because they couldn't stomach watching player time and time again, over and over again, hitting into the shift. It's the most frustrating thing in the world to watch. And for me, I look at this and I say, you guys are professionals. Figure out how to counteract what a team is, how they're defending you. Now we don't have a shift at all because people in Major League Baseball can't beat it. Come on now. Of course we could beat it. Just go the other way. And I know I'm making it sound easier than it probably is. I get it. but it's just, it's so frustrating sometimes. It really is. So, yeah.
Well, and when you try to bunt, that's gone the way of the dodo bird. Nobody knows how to bunt properly anymore, at least it seems that way, because you're right, Brock. If the shift is on and if they bunt to the left side because there's like nobody there on the left side, they're like in Canada rather than in the United States, then yeah, like they should be able to do that to be able to say, okay, I can get a hit this way. But with not doing the shift anymore, I think that's a good thing because Major League Baseball, they want more offense. So if they found through the statistics, through doing the shift, that more people were getting out, hopefully they're able to get more offense with not doing the shift anymore.
Yeah, it's really literally remove the shift so that we didn't have to stomach listening to guy hitting into the shift yet again. It's just, yeah. I didn't think it would come as soon as it did, but it did, and it's made for better baseball. What made for better baseball when I watched the game live the other day was watching Shohei Ohtani. And yes, I was cheering for the Toronto Blue Jays. I was, I promise. But I was really hoping to see something special from Shohei Ohtani, which I did not. And one of the big stories that's come out since we've last been on the program is that Shohei Ohtani will not be traded by the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim because they want to keep him. My argument to this is you got to get something for this player who is once in a 100 years you're going to see this, and you're going to see him hit and pitch it in the same game. To me, it would be an absolute crime if the Los Angeles Angels did not make the playoffs and he walks away in free agency and says bye-bye to the Angels and they get nothing. Some people would tell me, well, you know, they want to build around him. They want to acquire people. They want to do this. For me as a fan, I would rather get something than nothing for a guy like him who can do two things in the same game. And yes, as Dan Schulman and Buck Martinez have said in different broadcasts this week, you may have to pay him as a two-way player of, you know, one as a pitcher and one as a hitter, because that's how it might roll. Do you guys feel it would be a crime if they let him walk at free agency and yet didn't make the playoffs, Cameron?
Oh, it'd be an absolute crime. I would really hope that they know that they can re-sign him and that's why they're not trading him. Because otherwise, I think it's suicide because of being able to get the assets back that you would for him to try to retool your offense and pitching potentially. I think it's asinine if they ended up, not trading him without knowing whether or not he's going to sign back with Los Angeles.
Josh, thoughts?
The Angels are going to angel. They just... I don't understand this move at all. It makes no sense unless they have had conversations with him privately that say, yes, I will stay if you do X, Y, and Z. That's the only way I can see that this makes any sense. Otherwise, it is career-ending for the general manager, in my opinion, because you're going to watch him try to take you to the playoffs, probably come up just a bit short because you've had Mike Trout away, and yeah, I don't know what you're going to have if you let him walk.
That is the end of our show for this week. I'd like to thank Cam Jenkins, Josh Watson. I'd also like to thank our technical producer, Mark Aflalo. Ryan Delahanty is the podcast coordinator. Tune in next week because you just never know what happens when you enter the neutral zone. Be safe, be well.